So Daniel 11, starting at verse 2. Now then, I tell you the truth, three more kings will appear in Persia, and then a fourth, who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Then a mighty king will appear, who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. After he has appeared, his empire will be broken up and parceled out towards the four winds of heaven. It will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others. The king of the south will become strong, but one of his commanders will become even stronger than he and will rule his own kingdom with great power. After some years, they will become allies. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance, but she will not retain her power, and he and his power will not last. In those days, she will be handed over, together with her royal escort and her father and the one who supported her. One of her family line will arise to take her place. He will attack the forces of the king of the north and enter his fortress. He will fight against them and be victorious. He will also seize their gods, their metal images, and their valuable articles of silver and gold, and carry them off to Egypt. For some years, he will leave the king of the north alone. Then the king of the north will invade the realm of the king of the south, but will retreat to his own country. His sons will prepare for war and assemble a great army, which will sweep on like an irresistible flood and carry the battle as far as his fortress. Then the king of the south will march out in rage and fight against the king of the north, who will raise a large army, but it will be defeated. When the army is carried off, the king of the south will be filled with pride and will slaughter many thousands. Yet he will not remain triumphant. For the king of the north will muster another army larger than the first, and after several years, he will advance with a huge army, fully equipped. In those times, many will rise against the king of the south. The violent men among your own people will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, but without success. Then the king of the north will come out and build up siege ramps and will capture a fortified city. The forces of the south will be powerless to resist. Even their best troops will not have the strength to stand. The invader will do as he pleases. No one will be able to stand against him. He will establish himself in the beautiful land and will have the power to destroy it. He will determine to come with the might of his entire kingdom and will make an alliance with the king of the south. And he will give him a daughter in marriage in order to overthrow the kingdom, but his plans will not succeed or help him. Then he will turn his attention to the coastlands, and he will take many of them. But a commander will put an end to his insolence and will turn his insolence back upon him. After this, he will turn back towards the fortress of his own country, but stumble and fall and be seen no more. His successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. In a few years, however, he will be destroyed, yet not in anger or in battle. He will be succeeded by a contemptible person who has not been given the honor of royalty. He will invade the kingdom where its people feel secure, and he will seize it through intrigue. Yet an overwhelming army will be swept away before him. Both it and a prince of the covenant will be destroyed. After coming to agreement with him, he will act deceitfully, and with only a few people, he will rise to power. When the richest provinces feel secure, he will invade them and will achieve what neither his fathers nor his forefathers did. He will distribute plunder, loot, and wealth among his followers. He will plot the overthrow of fortresses, but only for a time. With a large army, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south. The king of the south will wage war with a large and very powerful army, but he will not be able to stand because of the plots devised against him. Those who eat from the king's provisions will try to destroy him. His army will be swept away, and many will fall in battle. The two kings, with their hearts bent on evil, will sit at the same table and lie to each other, but to no avail, because an end will still come at the appointed time. The king of the north will return to his own country with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. He will take action against it and then return to his own country. At the appointed time, he will invade the south again, but this time the outcome will be different from what it was before. Ships of the western coastlands will oppose him, and he will lose heart. Then he will turn back and vent his fury against the Holy Covenant. He will return and show favor to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. With flattery, he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. When they fall, they will receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. Some of the wise will stumble, so that they will be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. The king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will say unheard of things against the God of gods. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed, for what has been determined must take place. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the one desired by women, nor will he regard any god, but will exalt himself above them all. Instead of them, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god unknown to his fathers. He will honor with silver and gold and precious stones and costly gifts. He will attack the mightiest fortresses with the help of a foreign god and will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. He will make them rulers over many people and will distribute the land at a price. At the time of the end of the king of the south, at the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. He will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. He will also invade the beautiful land. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. He will extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. He will gain control of the treasures of gold and silver and all the riches of Egypt, with the Libyans and Nubians in submission. But reports from the east and the north will alarm him, and he will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch his royal tents between the seas at the beautiful holy mountain. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him.
I don't know what you thought when you went through Daniel 11, when we read through it. I wonder what I thought when I read through it first. I can tell you what I thought. I tried to trade with Mark. I said, look, you do this one and I'll do next week. But that didn't work. Even with money offered, still didn't work. But when you've done the work and when you get into it, and hopefully when we've done some work this morning together and you've really got into the chapter, you see what a glorious chapter it is. You remember from Daniel 10 that Daniel is given a glimpse into heaven. It's a bit like the revelation given to John in the book of Revelation, isn't it? Where he is given an opening into heaven and he sees the spiritual battle that's going on behind all the events in history. And just like John gets that vision, Daniel gets a vision of the spiritual realities behind the physical, the political realities, all the armies, all the people, all that's going on here. There's a spiritual battle that's always raging on. And we're given a glimpse of that. We're not to be obsessed by that, but to be aware of that. And that spiritual battle is shown to Daniel in order that then he can see the background to all the things that the spokesman for God, whether it be the Lord Jesus or whether it be an angel, the spokesman on behalf of God will tell him what's about to take place. What's about to take place in the context of God's people. So not just general history, but history that somehow affects God's people. We're given the purpose for the vision in chapter 10 and verse 14. It's worth just glancing at that, chapter 10 and verse 14. Now I have come to you to explain what will happen to your people in the future, for the vision concerns a time yet to come. And what we have in chapter 11 is a very detailed history from about 537 BC right through to the coming of Christ, maybe even beyond that. And it's probably not what the Jews expected. And that's why there's a number of reruns of this history through the book of Daniel, because it's not what's expected. It's going to be very alarming to the Jews. They probably expected the restoration of the kingdom when they returned back to their land. They probably expected the reign of a Messiah, but there was going to be a much longer wait than they could have possibly anticipated. And what we're going to do as we work through chapter 11 here is to look at the verses in front of us, in front of you, and for me to try and explain what actually happened in fulfillment of those words. So I'll be jumping between the verses and the reality. So there's lots of detail that will be what happened in history, which fulfills the word. So it's good to keep kind of looking down, looking up to the screen and see what went on, because it is truly remarkable. Just, it's an outstanding chapter once you get into it. So let's give it a go. Bear with me for a little while, and then we'll work away and say, well, why? Why is it here? Interesting stuff. I like geography. I like history. I don't like geography. I don't like history. But get to the end of it. Why is it here? And that's what we'll spend some moments looking at the end. So, firstly, Greece rules, verses 1 to 4. Verse 2 says, there's three more kings that will appear in Persia, and the fourth of those kings will be a person called Xerxes. Gets complicated because of all the different names, but here's the first name to dwell on. His name is Xerxes. He becomes very rich, probably the last great king of the Medo-Persian Empire, and he keeps irritating the Greeks by attacking them. And eventually he marches with 400,000 men against Greece. But it's quite interesting. See verse 3. Then a mighty king will appear who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. What happens is this great army marching against Greece. But do you remember what happened in the Euros about eight years ago? And Greece won, didn't they? Cheeky little Greece with their little army managed to win. And this is just what happens here. In this major battle, cheeky little Greece against massive Persia wins. Now, there's a whole load of history to that about Alexander the Great being skilled in battle and being, you know, from a very young age, able to ride horses and march out armies and stuff like that. But it's Alexander the Great who's there, and he beats the Persians, and he spends most of his life campaigning to establish an empire that stretches all this way over here into the east and all this way over here into the west and into North Africa, into what we call Egypt. And for the time that it took, it's phenomenal success that Alexander the Great had. Just standing back from it, not to do with this vision particularly, but maybe God had it in his mind that he wanted the Greek language to be everywhere, a language that was spoken by everyone across the known world then, and it was all ready for the spread of the gospel, that there was a common language across. But that's what happened, a language and a culture that influenced not only his empire, but also greatly influenced the Roman Empire as well. And then verse 4, after he has appeared, his empire will be broken up and parceled out towards the four winds of heaven. So what actually happened, which is quite surprising really, Alexander was this phenomenal success, but when he dies, which happens rather suddenly, at the age of 33, when he dies, his kingdom's divided into four. And in effect, eventually, well, quite soon, it's divided into three kingdoms, really. So it starts off as four, but eventually just into three. Macedonia and two more that we're going to concentrate on for the rest of this vision. So that's what we have from verses 5 through to 20. The so-called kings of the south and the north. And we're looking about from kind of 300 BC through to about 175 BC. And what we've got, and it's mentioned there in verse 5, the king of the south will become strong and so forth. And one of his commanders will become even stronger than he and will rule his own kingdom with great power. In the south, you've got Ptolemy, which begins with a P, of course. You've got Ptolemy in the south, Ptolemy Soter, who's in Egypt, and he has a commander called Seleucus. And he's a very successful commander, and he thinks, I rather like this commanding business. So he defects, and he goes to the north and establishes an empire in the north. So what you've got is the Seleucid Empire, which looks pretty chunky, although it's a slightly bigger map than the previous one, but it looks pretty chunky in the north, and that's his empire, the Seleucid Empire. He was a commander in the south, but he went north, established his empire in the north. That's the kingdom of the north. And then in the south, you'll see there, the Ptolemaic Empire. So it was one of these four Greek kingdoms that comes out of the kingdom of Alexander the Great. In the south, you've got Egypt. In the north, you've got the Seleucid Empire. And it's probably easier just to think of them as Egypt in the south, Syria, which is obviously a very familiar name to us now, in the north, because that was roughly the region. Egypt in the south, Syria in the north. And there's about 130 years described here of conflict between the south and the north. This is the bit where it gets a bit tricky to read, where you might need to refer. So verse 6, 35 years later, in the north, there's Antiochus II Theos, and in the south is Ptolemy Philadelphus, who gives his daughter Berenice. And the idea is, of course, to form an alliance between these two. See that in verse 6. After some years, they will become allies. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance. But she will not retain her power, says the prophecy. The aim is for these two kingdoms to come together, but it fails. Berenice's father dies. Berenice is killed herself. Antiochus II's child is also murdered. There's all kinds of intrigue and poisoning, and there's more poisoning to come a bit later on. So that doesn't work out. And then verses 7 through to 9, one from her family line, that's Berenice's. And it's Berenice's brother, who's Ptolemy III. He attacks Syria. He's successful. Many cities surrender. See that from verses 7 through to 9. Seizing gods, metal images, and so forth. And these wars continue. And then through to verses 10 through to 14. There's another 40 years of warring. And if we look at verse 10, his sons, this is the sons of the king of the north, will prepare for war and assemble a great army. There are two sons, but one son becomes prominent, and he's called Antiochus the Great. He's one of those two sons. He emerges victorious, and he has many victories. And that's described there in verses 10 through to 14. It's great army, great pride, great slaughter of many thousands, but still not overwhelmingly effective, but quite successful. And if you think about it, all this time, Israel is what you might describe rather crudely as the meat in the sandwich, aren't they? Because if you think about it, you've got Syria in the north, Egypt in the south. What's in between? Well, a few bits and pieces, but Israel, bang smack in between, squeezed between these two great warring empires. And so then in verse 15, where the king of the north again, this is Antiochus the Great, he comes and builds siege ramps. He's successful again. He has a decisive victory in the south. He's from the north. He has a decisive victory in the south in Egypt and decides then also, well, he invades the beautiful land as well. See that verse 16, the invader, Antiochus the Great, will do as he pleases. No one will be able to stand against him. He will establish himself in the beautiful land and will have the power to destroy it. It's going to affect God's people. This bit of history that seems to have nothing to do with them for a bit, it's getting closer, and now it's actually arrived at their doorstep. He's going to invade the beautiful land. And he's going to seemingly be invincible. Verse 16, the beginning part of, the invader will do as he pleases. And then verse 17. He will determine to come with the might of his entire kingdom and will make an alliance with the king of the south. And he will give him a daughter in marriage in order to overthrow the kingdom. But his plans will not succeed or help him. What Antiochus the Great actually does, as his predecessors had tried to do, or the predecessors in the south had tried to do in the north, was he gives in marriage his daughter, Cleopatra. Now, when I first read that, I thought, oh, I know her. You know, The Needle, the Shakespeare play, the Richard Burton film, Elizabeth Taylor. But it's not her. It's something like her great-great-grandmother, sort of removed a bit to the side. It's quite a common name. There's three or four Cleopatras, so I got well confused in that bit. But this is a Cleopatra from the north, and she marries the king of the south. Another great plan, let's make a great alliance. But it doesn't work out, because, kind of amusingly to me, she keeps siding with her husband in the south. So there's a dad in the north, you know, wanting to sort of control things in the south, but she, good wife that she is, keeps siding with her husband. So that doesn't work at all. And Antiochus the Great is rather frustrated by this. So verse 18, he will turn his attention to the coastline, that's the western coast, the Mediterranean coast, and will take many of them, but a commander will put an end to his insolence and will turn his insolence back on him. So he turns to the west because he's not having much success in the south. And guess who shows up? You can tell me if you read it, but you might know. Who shows up? Pardon? The Romans! Yeah, we love the Romans. They show up thinking, this guy is getting too big for his boots. So they turn up with their ships. There's a particular commander who comes across and who utterly defeats him. He's called General Lucius Scipio Asiaticus. And he repels Antiochus the Great, pushes him back in his place. The Romans don't quite invade the whole area yet, but they just want to make sure no one gets too powerful in that area. And that's pretty much the end of Antiochus the Great. Alexander the Great dies at 33. Antiochus the Great dies fairly young as well, dies rather suddenly, dies in strange circumstances, not quite sure what happened to him. And then we read about his son, verse 20. His son, who's called Seleucus the Fourth, he's left with loads of debts because, of course, Antiochus the Great had been marching around all over the place. Well, it all costs money. You've got to have boots for your soldiers and gold to give out and food to eat. So he'd used up all the money. So there's a massive tax needed. And as it says in verse 20, he would send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. So Seleucus got loads of debts. Guess what? He's not very popular because he raises massive taxes. And very soon after, I think in a couple of years, he's poisoned by his prime minister. Well, that's the kings of the north and the south. And then verses 21 through to 35, it's still staying with the same area, but it seems to focus on one person in particular, and a lot of time is given to him from verse 21 onwards. A so-called contemptible person. And we know that this contemptible person who then succeeded the poisoned Seleucus the Fourth is Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Epiphanes was a name he gave himself that means something like God manifest or the illustrious God, something like that. That's what he called himself. Actually, the Jews a bit later called him Antiochus Epimenes, which means he's a crazy guy, means madman or something like that. We've already met him in Daniel chapter 8 and Daniel chapter 9. So we knew he was coming. They would have known he was coming from those previous prophecies, but this gives an awful lot more detail and sets it more in a very specific historical context. By all accounts, whoever you are writing about Antiochus Epiphanes, you would say he's cunning, he's very powerful, he's cruel, he's foolish, he's greedy, he's brutal, he's a persecutor, he is completely obsessed with himself and his power. So he doesn't seem like God manifest, he seems more like a madman. And his first ambition will be the conquest of Egypt. So he will feel secure. And then verse 25, with a large army, he will stir up his strength and courage and go against the king of the south. Who's in the south? Tell me. Well, Ptolemies. Yeah, I was going to give you the easy name. What's in the south? Egypt. What's in the north? Try pronouncing that one in the north. Syria. It's an easy one. I was thinking you were going to say Seleucid. But Ptolemy and Seleucid, Egypt and Syria. So, the north invading the south. Are you all with it? I don't know what I'm going to say if you say no, because I can't really go back over it again. But he is a contemptible person, probably more power-hungry than all the rest, and he goes to invade the south, thinks this is it, we're really going to overcome them this time. And then again, you get a very amusing thing, verse 26. There's all kinds of plots. Those who eat from the king's provisions will try and destroy him. Lots of intrigue, people trying to top him, get rid of him, knock him off, but that doesn't work. And then verse 27, the two kings with their hearts bent on evil will sit at the same table and lie to each other, but to no avail. And do you know what? That's exactly what happened. They went, they had a banquet. Antiochus pretended he was going to share power with Ptolemy the Sixth. And Ptolemy the Sixth, he pretended to believe him. That's what the historians tell us happened. They sat there and they lied to each other. Oh, yes, I'm going to look after your kingdom and we're going to make an alliance. Oh, yeah, that would be a great idea. Yeah, can we just, you know, no intention at all of following through on any of the promises. They sat and lied to each other, just like Daniel was told. Verse 28, Antiochus Epiphanes, the crazy guy, he returns home. The king of the north will return to his own country with great wealth. He's extracted a bit of booty in that negotiation, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. And what happened in practice is that he partially destroyed Jerusalem at this time. It was one of the various attacks on Jerusalem and ransacking it. Not the destruction that came later, but the kind of first wave of that. And then, verse 29 and 30, Antiochus Epiphanes attacks again. Of course, he had no intention of keeping his promise, so of course he attacks again. And this time the outcome will be different, because guess who shows up in verse 30? The Romans! You ought to cheer for the Romans, maybe, at this point. So the Romans turn up, and they get him to turn back. See, at the appointed time, he will invade the south again, but this time the outcome will be different. Ships of the westland coastlands, that's where Rome is, over on the west, will oppose him, and he will lose heart. He's stopped by the intervention of Rome. There's a consul, Gaius Populus Lanus, and I think it's the first time, it may not be because it's difficult to work out where this phrase comes from, but the phrase, the line in the sand. They were getting fed up because Antiochus Epiphanes, they were trying to get him to agree that he wouldn't carry on invading Egypt, and he kept kind of, you know, trying to negotiate around it. And the Roman consul got something, a stick or something, a spear I think it was, and drew a line in the sand around Antiochus Epiphanes and said, you should try this with your children, until you agree, you can't step out of this line. That was the line in the sand. Of course, there were many other lines in the sand drawn and various battles and so forth, but it was very humiliating, you can imagine, for him. You know, this great Antiochus Epiphanes who'd won so many battles, and this Roman guy saying, look, you stand in there like a naughty little child and you're not allowed out until you agree that you're not going to invade Egypt anymore. So, of course, you know, all right then. Steps out of the line in the sand. But he's so angry, even more angry than he was before. And he goes now, verse 31, and desecrates the temple in Jerusalem. He tries to end all worship completely. He tries to get them to turn over to a holy Greek culture, worshipping Greek gods, no longer worshipping the true Lord. And he persecutes and he tries to curry favor with those who are willing to go with him. With flattery, verse 22, he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant. Those who are not really serious about worshipping the Lord, he takes with him, gets on his side. But the people who know their God, verse 32, will firmly resist him. There are some who are faithful, those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. When they fall, though, they will receive a little help. So there will be persecution, there will be plundering, there will be desecrating of the temple, there will be some who go over to Antiochus Epiphanes' side. Some will firmly resist, and there will be some help, verse 35. And we know that happened, that there was a famous person, Judas Maccabees, who gets a whole army together and eventually ejects the Syrians. That's what's celebrated in Hanukkah, which happens kind of just before Christmas. In the Jewish calendar. That's when they celebrate this great victory, when Judas Maccabees manages to eject the Syrians from there. Antiochus Epiphanes, by this time, is probably away from the beautiful land, away from Israel, and he hears about this victory of Judas Maccabees, and very soon after that, he dies. His end really does come. Suddenly, and at the appointed time. And then finally, we're nearly there, verse 36 through to 45, a king who does as he pleases. Verse 36, the king will do as he pleases. And of course, it's not immediately clear, if you've been following through, who the king is. Is it Antiochus Epiphanes? Does it carry on talking about him? Well, it seems not, just because of what's described. It seems as though it's describing something else. And I think that the most reasonable thing is to suggest that what is being described here is actually the coming of the Roman Empire. We've already had the Roman Empire predicted in Daniel 2, verse 40, and in Daniel 7 and verse 7. So we know the Roman Empire is coming in the vision of the great statue in chapter 2, in the vision of the beasts. There are these great empires, and Rome was the last of those. So probably it's talking about the Roman Empire. They did expand across much of Europe and Asia. There was ongoing persecution. Verse 36, they were very proud, and their pride was in their might and achievement. That's what they took great pride in. So there was a whole worship system, and there was culture and everything else. But what do they really worship? Military might above all else. So it's a pretty good description of them. They have a policy of setting up rulers in the land, so they overcome, and then they set up kind of local rulers who are loyal to Rome. So they don't try and sort of necessarily control everything with an army. They set up local rulers and give them some dosh to do that. And then verses 40 through to 45, there's this final period as Egypt and Syria try and get the Romans out, but the Romans keep invading and they take control. They take control of the beautiful land, in other words, Israel. And they permanently establish that rule there until the coming of Jesus and a little bit beyond. For the Jews, these were terrible times again. Another barbarous, distant nation overwhelming them, trampling them, persecuting them. And that's what seems to be being described here in this last section. But there's something about the way that it speeds up and the extensive language that's used that makes you think, well, this is taking us beyond that. In a sense, all the prophecy takes us beyond its immediate fulfillment to some principles, at least, of how persecution will continue. But this last section seems to kind of really take off in the way that it describes things, and seems to many who are commentating on this, looking at this, to be a parallel with looking at all these persecutions as a picture of the coming of the spirit of Antichrist that's described in the New Testament and the coming of the Antichrist that is described there. We haven't got time to look in that in detail, but it's in 2 Thessalonians 2, 4, 1 John 3, verse 18 and following that you can look at and I can talk about with you later. So although it talks about Rome, I think it takes us beyond Rome to something more, to that general persecution that would happen throughout the church age. So the Jews are given this detailed prediction to strengthen their faith and to help them in the reality of life from 400 BC through to the coming of Christ. How can we derive some benefit from it then this morning? Well, I want us just to reread and focus on the verses starting at verse 31. His armed forces, this is Antiochus Epiphanes, will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. They will set up the abomination that causes desolation. With flattery, he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. When they fall, they will receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. Some of the wise will stumble so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will come at the appointed time. I want us to think about three things from this detail that we've gone through. And I think you'll see whether you caught all the names and whether you got all the detail of it by kind of mapping it out like that. We've seen that there is an awful lot of detail. None of the names are in the text here. All of those names are what actually happened in history. They're in the fulfillment. And I think the first thing that we see really clearly from this is that God, our God, the Lord of the Jews, the Lord who is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, the Lord that we know through Jesus Christ, our God is the sovereign Lord of history. He's the sovereign God who's over all history and he knows all of history. What will help us stand firm in our days of temptation? It will be knowing that God is the Lord of history. What will stop us from giving up our faith when some circumstance comes into our life, some illness or death, some persecution or poverty, when that comes into our life, what will stop us giving up on God and saying, this is not fair, God is not right, God is not real? It will be to know that God is the Lord of history, even in the detail. I hope you've seen, as we've gone through chapter 11, the perfect, precise accuracy. It's probably unrivaled in the rest of the Bible in terms of prophecy for the precise detail and description of all little events. You know, kings sitting down at table, and marriages taking place, and big battles and little battles, and alliances being formed, and son here and father here, and all this stuff going on. And it's described in prophetic language, but refers precisely to the detail. Those descriptions corresponding exactly with what happened. God is involved in the detail, the rise of kingdoms, the armies, the territories, the marriages, the treaties, the surprises, the sudden deaths. He knows about them all. And he's sovereign over them all. You see, you get these guys, Alexander the Great, he's 33. He's bound bread. He's gone. God sets these people up. God gets rid of them. And you're there, and he's age 32. And you're so scared of Alexander the Great. Because he really rides horses well. And he really fights battles well. And he seems to be invincible. And do you know what happens? I think what happens is he goes to a party at his friend's house. And he drinks something that disagrees with him. And he's gone. Who's in charge? Not Alexander the Great. And for all his great empire, it divides into four. Who's in charge? God. He's the sovereign ruler over history in the big things and in the detail. And we see that that's true even when he's not mentioned. You have to wait really till those verses 30 in the 30s that we just read before there's any mention of God. So you've got 29 verses, political intrigue going on. And you think, where's God? Where's God? Where's God? Has he gone away? Has he given up? Where's God? He's absolutely right there. You go through the book of Esther, not a single mention of God in the whole book. Where's God? He's absolutely there, in control, ordering events, in the big things, in the detail, in the cup that Alexander the Great happens to drink from that day. There is God in the big things, in the detail. If you're a skeptic this morning about the Bible, if you're not sure if the Bible is God's truth, here is a massive chunk of evidence, like a roller coaster evidence to just knock you over in your skepticism, to say no one else could have possibly predicted all this amount of detail before it happened. Only God can reveal the truth of history, because only God knows all of history. He sees it all. It's kind of stretched out, laid out before him. He sees it all with perfect clarity. Only God can do that. If you're skeptical about the Bible, here's a massive chunk of evidence to say this is God's word. Look at these prophecies. Look at how they're fulfilled. And then spread across the whole of the Old Testament, there are so many prophecies about Jesus that are so precisely and perfectly fulfilled. It's evidence for the skeptic, but it's also evidence for us as believers this morning. If you're a Christian believer this morning, be assured. Be assured of the accuracy of the Bible. That's helpful, that's useful to know. But more personally, be assured that God's in control. God's in control in the detail of your life. Not a sparrow falls. Not a spider casts a web. There's not a pixel on a screen on your computer. There's not a status update that's given that God hasn't already seen. There's not a grain of sand that he doesn't know about. There's not a political fight. There's not a petty feud. There's not an ache and pain that you undergo. There's not a drop of rain. There is nothing in the whole universe that God doesn't comprehend and see clearly. What is he like? Can you imagine? All this detail, all known, all understood perfectly by him. Be assured. Be assured as you see the accuracy that he's in control and that he's working for you. So God is the Lord of history. Secondly, persecution is inevitable. Persecution is inevitable. You see that in those verses there about what happens to the Jews. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. That's a bit of a difficult thing to read, isn't it, if you're a Jew? It might be all right for us reading it because we're not there. But you've got this great prophecy, you've got this great sovereign Lord over history who's in charge of everything and knows all the detail. And then you read this bit that says, even the faithful, even the wise are going to get plundered and persecuted and squashed. It's hard. It's going to be hard for God's people. Persecution is inevitable. Persecution in some way is normally what will happen to God's people. And these persecutions that happened to the Jews are a pattern of what will happen in the New Testament to the Christian church, to those who are following Christ, to God's New Testament people, from Antiochus through to the Jews, then the Romans, through right through to the spirit of Antichrist that John says is in the world now. People who are following the pattern of Antiochus Epiphanes, following the pattern of the Roman Empire, the spirit of Antichrist, right through to the Antichrist, an individual who it seems from the way the New Testament speaks about it, it seems an individual will rise up and have particular power and particularly exalt themselves and seek to suppress the religion of the true God. That will be the pattern. What we see here happening to the Jews is the pattern of what will happen to the church. And there are many across the world who are suffering that kind of persecution. Here's a map. There was a report recently from the Open Doors organization, their 2016 report. And I've got a copy of it here for anyone who wants to have a kind of flick through it. And it talks about the top 25 countries where there is significant persecution. The red is where the persecution is worst. All kinds of countries where God's people are being persecuted. There is, as it says in the report, Islamic extremism, bringing the country under the House of Islam through violent actions. There's religious nationalism, one religion defined as the sole basis for national identity. This tribal antagonism, the continuing influence of age-old norms and values shaped in a tribal context. There's denominational protectionism, churches who do not recognize or want to give room to Christians outside their churches. There's still, unbelievably, communist oppression, seeking to maintain communism as the national ideology. There's aggressive secularism attempting to eradicate the Christian faith from public and private domain. There's organized corruption, the creation of impunity, anarchy and corruption, and this totalitarian paranoia. There's a picture of a man in the report, and he has 20 children, but most of them are not his own. He's in Laos, and he holds up a picture of a fellow pastor, and he says, "Persecution is intense. Pastors disappear regularly. This person in the photo from the Hmong church was told by his neighbours they didn't want a Christian in their village, but he continued to hold meetings in his home. On the 7th of March, he disappeared. His body was found in the forest 3 days later. He left a wife and 4 children. Other pastors look after the children after they've disappeared." And there's another picture of a man who's in prison. When he converted to Christianity, his village said he had to leave because he was now a Christian, but he refused to leave. Sorry, he couldn't afford to leave. So he was banished from the village, couldn't afford to leave, so they put him in prison. And there are, of course, many stories, multiple stories like that. There is persecution going across the world. And when they're experiencing that, they need to understand, and we need to understand, that this is not unexpected. This is not a surprise to God. There are many who are literally having their lives desecrated and trampled on in a similar way to what was experienced by the Jews. Pressure to resist the new covenant worship. Pressure to say, let's turn over to our gods, whether it is the gods of some secular culture or the gods of Islam or some other religion. But there's also growing opposition in all kinds of societies that are not in the top 25. Our own society, where Christian attitudes are seen as intolerant, as in some quarters, evil. Quite a good section of the population would think about many of our attitudes as being fundamentally evil, at the root of evil. And we're being asked to accept the prevailing culture. I don't know what will happen with the Ofsted thing, whether it's a bit of a storm in a teacup or whether they will end up needing to or wanting to actually come and inspect. But it's not so much whether that will become a law at this point. It's the fact that it was even on the agenda. It's just outstanding. It's a remarkable feature of our society that the government would want to come in and to somehow legislate that we don't teach truths that may contradict the prevailing culture. Maybe nothing will come of it, or maybe Ofsted will inspect, and maybe it'll be fine, I don't know. I don't want to be alarmist about it, but the fact that that's even on the table suggests that persecution of a reasonable intensity is not that far away. So it's not a surprise, and we shouldn't be surprised by it. But also, note that it's purposeful. It's not just arbitrary. See what God says through Daniel. Some of the wise will stumble, verse 35, so they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. You know what's remarkable? I think you know this. The places where the persecution is fierce, the growth of the gospel is immense. People, just like the people in this text, as they face persecution, their faith is refined. What's really there is shown. The gold is shown in all its beauty. True faith becomes clear. So it's purposeful. It's not arbitrary. And it is limited. See that emphasis right through this, this chapter on the end will come. The appointed time will come. And that's true of the persecution that happened under Antiochus Epiphanes. It's true of the persecution that happened under Rome. It will be true of the persecution across the world, that it will come to an end. In particular places, it will come to an end. But in the big sweep of history, the end will come. There will be an end to persecution, and justice will be done and seen to be done, and God will be with his people. So, third lesson. The first one was that God is the Lord of history. Take heart in that. The second is that persecution in some form is inevitable, and we don't wish it upon ourselves, and we don't make direct comparisons with those who are persecuted across the world, but we will experience some degree of persecution here, and do, and temptation, and push, and shove towards compromise. So what do we need to do? We need to know our God Isn't that a great shaft of light in this chapter at the end of verse 32? You kind of read it and it warms your heart in this very difficult chapter with bits you didn't understand. And if you didn't understand any of the rest of the chapter, you understand this bit, the end of verse 32. The people who know their God will firmly resist him. The people who know their God will firmly resist. They know God through his word. They talked about the wise who will instruct one another, and they will know enough of God to know, we knew this was coming, we know God is faithful, so we will stand firm on his word. The people who know their God will be preserved. The people who know their God will resist Antiochus Epiphanes, and they won't want to compromise. The people who know their God won't be seduced by his lies and his flattery, and they won't be cowed into submission by his military might. The people who know their God will bear up, and there will be a remnant. And even right through to the time of Jesus, there will be those who are faithful. There will be those who are waiting for the coming of the Messiah. They know their God. They've instructed each other. They've kept faithful. Really, that's the only way. It's the only way to make sense of history. Yes, God is the Lord of history. We trust that. But in order to keep our faith in God, the Lord of history, even amongst persecution, the way to know that is to know our God. How can we know God? Well, of course, we know him now through the Lord Jesus Christ. Jesus has come and finally and fully revealed God to us. He shows us what God is like. He shows us what God wants. We know our God through Jesus. We know our God through the Word of Christ, through the New Testament scriptures that bring to light the Old Testament scriptures and explain to us about God. How can we know our God? It's through reading his Word. And what can we do with this? Well, then we can instruct others. That's the encouragement here. Those who instruct others. We want to be those who instruct others in the word so many people will know our God, because it's the only way to stand firm. Faithful teachers must go on teaching the truth even when there's great personal cost. As we go into chapter 12, we're looking more towards the end of the end. Looking after these times, and there's great encouragement in that. But even in this chapter, even before we get to the end, there is great encouragement for us this morning. God is the Lord of history, even in the detail. There will be persecution. It's purposeful to refine us. It's limited in duration. It will come to an end. How can we stand in that? It's by knowing our God. It's the only way to make sense of history. It's the only way to make sense of the difficult things that come into your life, is to know God through his word. And I encourage you to come along this evening when we think about reading God's word. How will you stand against temptation? How will you stand against persecution? Well, it's by reading God's word. Of course, studying it together like we are this morning, but reading it as part of your regular habit, because that's how you're going to know your God. And when the day of persecution or poverty or temptation comes, you will be able to stand. You will be able to firmly resist because you know God.